Welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Maitland. Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you, but the information on this podcast should not be considered legal advice. The views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or Queen's Faculty of Law. With the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg last year and the appointment of an anti-abortion judge to the Supreme Court of the United States, discussions of Roe v. Wade, the case that secured the right to abortion for Americans, came to surface. While Canadians might not feel the same threat to our reproductive rights, and especially our constitutional right to an abortion, Canada faces its own issues of access to reproductive services. Widespread systemic racism is still prevalent in reproductive health care, especially for Indigenous women. Access to abortion care is an issue, particularly in the East Coast, where only three hospitals in New Brunswick provide funded abortions. Clinic 554, a provider of reproductive and trans health care in Fredericton, was recently forced to shut down due to the premier's refusal to fund abortions in private clinics. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association is suing the provincial government for its policy, which is a breach of the Canada Health Act. Only 3 years ago, people in PEI received access to abortions on their island for the first time in over 30 years. Until then, islanders were forced to travel to neighboring provinces to receive abortions, a significant financial barrier that also threatens people's right to keep their abortion private. Reproductive justice isn't as impressive in Canada as we'd like to think. Lack of adequate government funding, issues of access for rural and northern communities, and a history of human rights abuses against Indigenous women show that Canada still has a long way to go. In this episode, we'll be talking about some of the differences in reproductive justice in Canada and the US, and why we use the term reproductive justice. I'll be joined by Professor Lisa Kelly, who teaches Queen's Law's first sexual and reproductive justice course, to discuss some of these issues and how we can use the law to address them. Lisa Kelly is an assistant professor at Queen's Law, where she teaches criminal law, evidence, and sexual and reproductive justice. She's also currently researching policing in schools with funding from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. She obtained her bachelor's at UBC, her JD at the University of Toronto, and her SJD at Harvard University, where she was a Trudeau Scholar. Before joining Queen's, Professor Kelly was a fellow at Columbia Law School and the Center for Reproductive Rights in New York. Her research has focused on the intersections of criminal and family law, including the ways in which the state governs sex, reproduction, and family life.
How did you first become involved in reproductive justice? What drew you to this area of the law?
Yeah, so I completed my law degree at the University of Toronto Faculty of Law, and I was fortunate enough when I studied there to be able to participate in a really robust program called the International Program on Sexual and Reproductive Health. And it really exposed me early on in law school to the significance of sexual and reproductive justice issues, both really at an individual level, but also at a societal level. Sometimes when we think about sexual or reproductive justice issues, people tend to emphasize individual decisions, individual struggles, individual self-determination. And that's certainly very true. But what also became obvious to me from early on in my work in this area is that you can't really understand or engage or contest systems and population-wide struggles if you're not talking and thinking about sexual and reproductive justice, whether that is about participation in the economy, whether it's about colonial and genocidal projects, frankly, whether it's about women and gender non-binary people's ability to live freely and to kind of control the paths of their lives, and also for children and young people to be able to flourish as individuals, but also as a next generation, and for families to be able to safely and healthily raise those generations. So what really stood out to me, I think, was that the issue, again, as I said, is sometimes framed as a private individual issue. We hear a lot of language around choice, the kind of liberal individual discourse, But I really thought, particularly in a law school, that you can't understand the system as a whole if you're not thinking about these issues.
So we've used this term reproductive justice a lot, and although our listeners are probably familiar with the reproductive rights movement, this term reproductive justice hasn't quite broken into the mainstream yet. So what are some of the differences between reproductive rights and reproductive justice, and what are the benefits of using the reproductive justice approach?
Right. So this is a really, really important question and a really important site to think about language, tactics, strategies, and really the vision of a movement. So as you noted in the course that I teach, which is called Sexual and Reproductive Justice, we examine the rise of reproductive justice as a movement, primarily credited and referenced to a group of women of color who in the United States were finding, particularly as they came into the early 90s, but really reproductive justice has been going on for much longer. But the term really is commonly attributed to the advocacy of women of color in the early 90s who found that the mainstream reproductive rights movement was not adequately capturing or representing the fulsome needs of often marginalized groups. And what they argued was that the reproductive rights movement had tended to be, as the term right suggests, had tended to be heavily organized around, not exclusively, but often around law and litigation as a means of achieving vindication of reproductive rights. And in terms of issues, the reproductive rights movement had also for a long time centered the issue of abortion, the law of abortion, and to a lesser extent, tangible material access to abortion services. This obviously remains central as well to the vision and agenda of reproductive justice advocates, but they also stressed that for many groups and populations and individuals, the central issue that they face is not simply an ability to terminate an unwanted pregnancy, but to actually also have children and to raise children in safe and sustainable environments. We've seen this a long, long history in terms of the Canadian state's efforts to assimilate and to kind of roll out a long genocide against First Nations people that has centered on coercive and forced sterilization, for example. And there, the primary, one of the primary reproductive justice issues that Indigenous peoples have faced is the ability to actually birth children in a safe and culturally grounded setting, and that's what was often deprived to them. So it's really about widening the scope, about thinking about strategies within but also outside the law, political advocacy, grassroots social movement advocacy, and also often centering the material experiences of people. So not merely insisting on a legal right, sometimes on paper, but what does it mean for people to actually be able to, in their own material realities, to be able to access services in a manner that upholds their dignity. So that's why I think it's a powerful frame that really allows us and requires us to ask broader questions than maybe the more narrow reproductive rights frame tended to. And I would say that the critique has really been profoundly successful, and we see, I think, that has been the direction that really the movement in this area has taken.
So there's often a lot of comparison between Canada and the US on this front, and I think especially around abortion. When Amy Coney Barrett was appointed to the Supreme Court in the US, there was a lot of discussion around Roe v. Wade and whether that would be overturned. And although the Supreme Courts in both of our countries have found a constitutional right to an abortion, it seems like politicians and judges in Canada are much less willing to as is often said, reopen the debate about criminalizing abortion. Do you think this is just a difference of political culture and values, or is there any reason to believe that Morgenthaler is a stronger protection of reproductive rights?
So you've really put your finger on a number of really important questions here, and I would say a few things. I think one of the things that's interesting about, and frankly disturbing about the trajectory of abortion rights litigation in the US is that in public discussions, I think there is a lot of attention given to Roe and whether Roe will fall and whether on this conservative controlled bench, whether they will kind of strike the decisive blow to Roe. I personally am of the view, and I'm certainly not alone on this, that we have already seen in the U.S. over the past number of decades a death by a million cuts strategy toward abortion rights and abortion access. So I'm not sure, and I probably doubt when these justices think about the legitimacy of their own institution that they will necessarily come out with a totalizing overturning of Roe. But I think you will see a court in its current configuration that is more likely to uphold various restrictions and regulations around abortion access that in terms of material reality will continue to make it exceptionally difficult for some people throughout the country to access abortion services in fact. And I think, again, to kind of go back to the reproductive justice framework, I think what that shows is that despite having a right on paper to essentially have the state stay out of one's decision around a pregnancy up until a certain stage, at least in that pregnancy, whether one can actually in fact access a safe termination is a whole other question. So I think that you will see as anti-abortion groups have worked very hard over the last few decades to push state legislatures to introduce regulations that restrict how and who can provide abortion services, what kinds of, you know, how big do the hallways have to be in an abortion clinic? Does that doctor have to have privileges in a local hospital, even though we know that that's neither medically necessary nor in some cases politically feasible for that doctor to get privileges? I think those are the kinds of regulations that a differently configured court has at times struck down. And I think as the politics on the court have changed, we may see movement on that. The question about Canada, I think, is a good one. I think that's right, that we have not seen any political appetite at a federal level to kind of quote unquote reopen the abortion debate in terms of, certainly in terms of criminal law. I think it does tell us something about the different political cultures. I think there are reasons that are specific to the United States, why the issue of abortion from the time of Roe v. Wade since has kind of captured and coalesced a number of social movements, including amongst evangelical Christians, certain parts of the Catholic hierarchy, as well as, you know, certain groups that want to preserve certain forms of quote-unquote traditional morality. And it's obviously become a kind of litmus test for the Republican Party. We have not seen that same set of political forces coalesce around the issue of abortion in Canada. And so I don't see that, at least in the foreseeable future. Certainly the current leader of the Conservative Party of Canada has indicated, Aaron O'Toole, that he has no interest, I think, in opening this kind of quote-unquote social issue either. I think the question of law and culture, though, is one to watch, right? So we continue, regardless of the fact that there is in at least some parts of Canada, and we can talk about that in a moment, about parts of Canada where there continues to be serious issues around access. But in parts of Canada where there is kind of generally readily available access to abortion services. That doesn't mean that abortion has been destigmatized. It doesn't mean, for instance, that Canadian women or trans men who access abortion services talk about it openly, or that there has been a kind of cultural reckoning with what it means for people to really have reproductive self-determination. So that, I think, is probably for reproductive justice advocates, is where some of those cultural and social discussions need to go.
So you've mentioned a few times in your answer this issue of abortion access, and you've studied before the topic of abortion travel in the US. Can you say a bit about your findings from that research and whether you see that same phenomenon in Canada?
Sure. So abortion travel, I think, became of great interest and concern to me and to many other advocates and scholars working in this area, because it represents, in part, what it represents is what we might call a kind of safety valve. And it's a kind of a safety valve. I think of it in part as a safety valve, in that restrictive jurisdictions have either formally, sometimes in their legal arguments, or at least as a matter of political expediency, have often relied on the fact that particularly people in their jurisdictions that have resources have often, in fact, been able to access terminations, even when the law on the books would prevent them from doing so, right? So even before Roe, which essentially kind of restricted states' ability to criminally regulate or restrict abortion up until a certain stage of the pregnancy, even before Roe, people with resources in the United States were able to travel domestically, whether that was to kind of safer providers who were operating off the books, but also internationally. And likewise, after Roe, when abortion remained highly restricted in Canada, some women with the means or the resources or the capacity, as various historians who have done great work on abortion travel in Canada have shown, traveled to the United States in a kind of clandestine fashion to access abortion. So it provides a somewhat of a safety valve where you're not, I mean, the state is on the books and in fact is restricting a practice, but elites remained often still able to access that service in reality. What we've seen in the United States, and also though an ongoing concern in Canada, is that even when abortion is, you know, not formally restricted, at least in up to a certain stage in the pregnancy, people are forced in many states today and in parts of Canada to travel significant distances if they are going to be able to access a termination. And, you know, I don't need to tell your listeners that, you know, if one thinks about the practicalities of taking, you know, a 300 kilometer trip to access a health service that you may already be accessing in a somewhat covert or discreet manner because of the stigma that attaches to a termination, that is both materially, economically, and psychologically very burdensome, right? You may have to take time off work if you already have other children, which most people accessing abortion services often do. You may need to organize childcare. If you're in a U.S. jurisdiction that imposes waiting periods where you have to initially consult with a provider and then have a 24 or 48 hour waiting period in which, you know, you're supposed to really mull over the seriousness of your decision because the state doesn't trust you to make your own decision, you can see how that is economically and as I said, though, also psychologically and socially burdensome, right? Joanna Erdman has written about this in the context of Atlantic Canada and the Maritimes, where there can be a sense that you are being kind of banished or exiled from your home jurisdiction because you are contravening the social mores of what it is to be part of that political community. And I think that, you know, it's a topic and a focus that I think when I teach it in class, that students in Canada are both very concerned about, and I think also really interested to address in a more sustained way, because they can readily see what a significant burden this continues to be on many people. So I think it's one of those issues that cross cuts and really reveals the class, race, urban, rural issues that really organize and mediate how people get to access health services, and really how inequality and inequity is often kind of hard baked into the structure.
It's the second year now that Queen's Law is offering the sexual and reproductive justice course. Why did you decide to bring this course to Queen's, and what has it been like so far teaching it?
So I brought a research interest in this area with me when I joined Queen's. I completed a postdoc right before I joined the faculty at Columbia Law School in New York, and also with the Center for Reproductive Rights in New York City, which funded that postdoc. So I brought a research and advocacy interest in the area, but I have to say that early in my teaching career here at Queen's, a number of students approached me and asked, could I, when my teaching load would increase to a full load, could I, or would I consider dedicating a seminar specifically to this issue and this area of study? And so I could sense that there was real interest amongst the student body for a course that had never historically been offered at Queen's. And that has turned out true. The course has been over-enrolled both times that it has been offered, kind of at capacity. And I think that really demonstrates that there is both an interest and also a really sophisticated level of understanding about the ways in which, as I've said, that reproductive justice is really central to many of the areas of law that we study, but has continued maybe not necessarily to get the full weight and attention that it should in legal education. So it has been, I have learned an enormous amount teaching it, but really from engaging with the students and from engaging with the scholars, advocates, and practitioners working in this area. And I hope that we can continue to learn and work together at Queen's on these really important questions.
Thank you, Professor, so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And it's been great to have you talk about these really important issues. And it's great to have this expertise at Queen's Law.
Thank you so much, Maitland. Really, I can't emphasize enough how important it is for students to be active, to agitate, and to make clear what they want in the curriculum and what's important to them. And this course, I think, has been a real expression of that. So thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. The views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, producer, or Queen's Faculty of Law, and the information provided in this podcast should not be considered legal advice. For more information about Pro Bono Radio, go to probonoradio.com.